house and yours. I bought a coat, I shaved, I took a gig to your father's house, but, sir, I could not ring the bell. I returned home distraught and cowed, and then I made a blunder, seeing in the shipping news that Alistair Lauderback, lawyer, was departing for the colonies next tide. I believed it was my father. I did not know he had a son. I did not think that son might share his name. That ship departed, but I was sharp upon the next. I landed at Dunedin, and began to make inquiries as my fortunes would allow. I attended your public address, the one conducted in the rain upon the Wharf, where the harbour master made you a present of a pocket watch, and you seemed very well pleased. When I saw you, I knew at once that I had erred, and you were not my father, but my brother. I was too anguished to confront you then, and now you are in Littleton, a place to which I cannot afford to sail. Sir, I write with a request, a prayer. I have spent my father's £20 on this journey and other necessaries, and I have not the means to return home. I have sold my coat, but it fetched little more than half the price I paid, for the broker did not believe it was a fine one. I have now but pennies to my name. You are a dignitary, sir, a man of politics, philosophy, and law. I do not need to meet you, but I beseech you for your charity, believing you a good and Christian man, and because I will remain always your brother, Crosby Wells.
There was a forwarding address beneath his name, a post office box in Dunedin. Moody put down the letter with a beating heart. So Lauderback and Crosby Wells were brothers. That was a turn of events indeed. But Lauderback had not mentioned this connection to the magistrate when he admitted to having arrived at Crosby Wells' deathbed half an hour too late. Nor had he confessed it to his friend, the shipping agent Thomas Balfour. What reason did he have to conceal his brother's illegitimate parentage? Shame, perhaps? Or something else? Moody took up the bundle and moved to the window where there was more light. He unfolded the next letter and tilted it towards the glass.
Dunedin, September 1852. Sir, 6 months have passed since I first wrote, and I fear by your silence that I have offended you. I cannot recall my phrasing exactly, but I do recall that in my last address I styled myself your brother, and perhaps that caused you grief. I imagine that it pains you to know that your father was a less than perfect man. I imagine that you wish it otherwise. If the above is true, then I beg forgiveness. Sir, in these past months my fortunes have fallen further still. I assure you that as a whoreson I am not unaccustomed to the beggar's life, but to beg a man a second time is shame indeed. Nonetheless, I write in desperation. You are a man of means. The cost of a third-class ticket is all I ask, and thenceforth you needn't hear of me again. Here in Dunedin, I save my pennies as I can. I've tried my hand at navvy work, but find myself ill-suited to the trade. I've been laid very low by chilblains and fever and other ills pertaining to the cold. I have not worked as steadily as I should have liked to do. My desire to meet our father, Alistair Lauderback Sr., has not diminished, and I am conscious of the passing days, for as I told you, he confessed to me in writing that he was very close to death. I should like to speak to him but once before that sad event, just so that we might lay eyes on one another and speak as men. Please, sir, I ask you on my knees to buy my passage home. You would not hear of me again, I swear. I am nothing more than your grateful friend, Crosby Wells.
Moody hardly paused before turning to the next. With his free hand, he fumbled for a chair and sank into it, still reading.
Dunedin, January 1853. Sir, how ought I read this silence? That is the question on my mind. I believe you are in receipt of my correspondence, but for some reason of principle you decline to answer or to extend a scrap of charity to your father's bastard child. These letters did not take dictation. This is mine own hand, sir, and I can read as well, and though I flatter myself, I shall tell you that my parish priest, Father Wells, remarked more than once that I was an uncommonly bright boy. I state all this to make it clear I am no scoundrel, though my station is a low one. Perhaps you wish for proof of my bastardy. Perhaps you think this is an attempted swindle. I say on my honour, it is not. Since I wrote to you last, my needs and wishes are unchanged. I do not want to be in this country, sir. I never sought this life. For £20, I would return to England and never speak your name again. Yours truly, Crosby Wells. Dunedin, May 1853. Sir, I know from the provincial papers that you have taken up the post of superintendent of the proud province of Canterbury. You took the post and offered up your honorarium for charity, a noble gesture, sir, but one I observed with sadness. I wondered if you thought of me as you gave that £100 away. I have not the means to travel to Littleton, where you are, much less back home. I have never felt more alone than I do in this forsaken land. Surely you will understand this as a British man yourself. We have creeping damp and frost indoors. I wake most mornings with a rime of ice across my legs. I am not suited to the hard frontier and mourn my circumstances daily. Sir, in this year past, I have saved only £2, 10 shillings and 4p, and I have now spent 4p upon these pages and postage. I beg of you to help. A man in need, Crosby Wells. Dunedin, October 1853. Sir, I write in great dejection. I am certain now that you will never write back to me, and even I, a Horson, am too proud to beg again. I am a sinner like our father, the apple falling never far, as the common saying goes. But in my youth I was taught that charity is a primary virtue, and one to be practised most especially when that virtue is not due. You, sir, are not behaving as a Christian man. I do believe that if our respective circumstances were reversed, I would not maintain the cruel silence that you keep with me. Rest assured, I will not beg your charity again, but I wish to make my dejection known to you. I have been following your career in the pages of the Otago Witness, and I know you are a man of no small means and much opinion. I have neither privilege, but notwithstanding my abject position, I am proud to call myself a Christian man, and if you were in need, sir, I should turn my pockets out to help you as your brother. I do not expect that you will reply, and perhaps I will die soon, and you will never hear from me again. Even in the likelihood of that event, I am proud to remain yours very sincerely, Crosby Wells. Dunedin, January 1854. Sir, I must apologise for the letter I wrote you last, as it was written bitterly and with the purpose of insulting you. My mother warned me never to touch a pen when in a temper, and now I see the wisdom in her words. My mother you have never known, of course, but she was quite a beauty in her time. Sue Butcher was her name in life, God rest her soul, though she also went by other names better suited to her line of work, and liked to invent new ones at her pleasure. She was our father's particular favourite, a preference that was formed, she said, upon the handsome colour of her eyes. I do not resemble her except in pieces. She always said that I bore my father's likeness, though my father never returned to the oarhouse after I was born, and as you know, I never met him. I've been told that prostitution is a social ill composed of male licentiousness on the one hand and female depravity on the other. And although I know this to be the opinion of wiser men than I, nevertheless, it does not make sense of how I remember my mother in my mind. She had fine pipes, and loved to sing all manner of hymns in the morning, a practice that I also loved. I believe she was kind and hard-working, and although she was known to be a flirt, she was a very good one. How strange that we have separate mothers but share a father. I suppose it means that we are only half alike. But forgive these idle meditations, and please accept my apologies and my assurance that I remain yours, Crosby Wells. Dunedin,
June 1854.
Sir, perhaps it is right you do not reply. You are acting only as a man of your high station can, and you have a reputation to consider. I think I have become contented with your silence, strange though that might sound. I have secured a modest wage and decent lodgings, and I am settling down, as they term it here. I find Dunedin much changed in the summer months. The sun is bright on the hills and on the water, and I can bear the briskness very well. How odd it is that I should find myself on the contrary face of the world. I believe that I'm as far from England as any man could be. You will be surprised to learn that I'm not to return home after all. I have resolved to make New Zealand the land in which I will be buried. Perhaps you wonder what spurred this change of heart, and so I shall tell you. You see, in New Zealand, every man has left his former life behind, and every man is equal in his way. Of course, the flock masters of Otago are barons here, just as they were barons in the Scottish Islands. But for men like me, there is a chance to rise. I find this very cheering. It is not uncommon for men to tip their hats to one another in the street, regardless of their station. For you, perhaps, this is not a strange occurrence, but for me, it is a wondrous one. The frontier, I think, makes brothers of us all, and in making this remark, I shall remain yours very truly, Crosby Wells. Dunedin, August 1854. Sir, you will, I hope, forgive these letters. I have no other correspondence, and thoughts of you consume my days. I have been waxing philosophical myself in thinking what might have happened if you knew me sooner, or if I knew you. I do not know your age, so I do not know if you are the elder or if I am the elder. In my mind the difference signifies, and because I am the bastard I imagine myself younger, but of course that might not be the case. There were other children in the Orehouse, several girls who grew up oaring, and one boy who died of smallpox when I was very young, but I was the eldest always, and I should have liked a brother to admire. I've been thinking with much sadness upon the fact that I do not know whether you have sisters and brothers, or if there are other bastards, or if your father ever spoke of me to you. If I were in London, I'll be taking every chance to walk to Glen House and look in through the railings and spy my father, whom you remember I've never seen. I have his letter still. It says he knew of me and watched me, and I wonder what he thought of me and what he might think about the life I lead here. But perhaps he is no longer living. You wish not to be my brother, you have made that clear, but perhaps you are as my priest with our correspondence as confession. I am heartened by this notion, for I say with pride that I was properly confirmed. But I expect you are a Church of England man. Yours, Crosby Wells. Dunedin, November 1854. Sir, do you feel as if you know me, or could pick me from a crowd? It struck me lately that I know your likeness, though you do not know mine. We are not so dissimilar in our physique, though I am slighter, I think, and my hair is darker than yours, and folk would likely say that yours is the kinder face, because my expression is too often sullen. I wonder if you walk about and think of me, and if you search for fragments of my features in other people's faces or their bodies when they pass you by. That is what I did every day when I was young, and dreaming always of my father, and trying to piece him from all the faces I had known. How comforting to think of all that unites us as brothers living at the end of the world. You are the subject of my repeating thoughts today. Sincerely, Crosby Wells. The next letter in the sequence was much crisper, and the ink much brighter. Moody looked at the date and noticed that nearly a decade had elapsed since Crosby Wells' last correspondence. Dunedin, June 1862. Sir, I will renew my correspondence to inform you very proudly that I write this as a married man. The courtship was a very short one, though I believe the script followed conventional themes. In recent months, I've been digging the gullies at Lawrence, and though I have amassed a competence, I am yet to truly strike. Mrs. Wells, as I must call her now, is a fine specimen of the female sex, and one I shall be very proud to carry on my arm. I suppose she is your sister now. I should like to know if you have a sister already, or if Mrs. Wells is your very first. You shall not hear from me for some time after this, for I must return to Dunstan in order to provide for my wife. What are your thoughts on the gold rush, I wonder? Recently I heard a politician speak who called the gold a moral scourge. It is true that on the diggings I have seen much degradation, but there was degradation prior to the strike as well. I fancy that it is the thought of men like me becoming rich that has most politicos afraid. Cordially, Crosby Wells. Kawarau, November 1862. Sir, I read in the papers that you are recently married, for which I offer my heartiest congratulations. I have not seen a picture of your wife, Caroline, nay Goff, but she is reported to be a very fine match. I am happy when I think that we will both spend our Christmases as married men. I will journey back from Lawrence to spend the season with my wife, who keeps her lodgings in Dunedin, and does not come to the diggings, as she cannot bear the mud. I've never become used to Christmas in the summertime, and feel the tradition as a whole is suited best to the colder months. Perhaps I blaspheme to talk of Christmas so, but I esteem that there is much that does not retain its meaning here in New Zealand, seeming instead like a faded relic from another time. I think of you receiving this letter, and sitting down beside the fire, perhaps, or leaning close into the lamplight to make out the words. Permit me to invent these details. It is a great pleasure always for me to think of you. I assure you that I remain from afar, yours very truly, Crosby Wells. Dunstan, April 1863. Sir, I have passed this week in a melancholy humour, wondering if Alistair Lauderback, our father, is yet deceased, as I expect he is. London seems but a dream to me now. I recall the smoke and fog, and cannot trust my own memory at all. As an experiment last week, I sat down and tried to draw a map of Southwark in the dirt. I could hardly remember the shape of the Thames, and no street names returned to me. Is it the same for you, I wonder? I read in the Otago Witness with some astonishment that you now style yourself a proud Cantabrian. I feel English through and through. Yours, Crosby Wells. Kawarau, November 1863. Sir, I like to think that you receive my words with pleasure, but am content with the more probable event that you do not read them at all. In either case, writing is a comfort to me, and give shape to my days. I read with interest that you have resigned the superintendency. The word upon the diggings here is that Canterbury is soon to have her rush in gold following Otago's fade, and I rather wonder whether such a discovery would make you regret your decision to step down from that eminent position. The reward offered for a payable goldfield has excited more than one man upon the fields here at Kawarau. The land is steep, and the sky very blinding here. I have been sunburned so often that the shape of my collar has been branded into my neck, and though this is painful, I do not look forward to the winter months, which in this high country will be bitter indeed. If gold is discovered in Canterbury, will you run for the super again? I do not mean that as an interrogative in the proper sense, just as an expression of my curiosity in the course of your days. It is in this spirit that I sign myself, sincerely, Crosby Wells. Kawarau, March 1864. Sir, I write with most important and indeed astonishing news. I have been in Dunstan, where I hit upon some extraordinary luck, a claim veritably shining with the colour. I am now a wealthy man, though I have not spent a penny of it, having seen too many fellows spend their dust on hats and coats, only to return those items to the pawnbrokers when their fortunes change again. I will not tell you the amount for fear this message is intercepted, but I will say that even by your handsome salary it is an enormous sum, and I fancy that now I am the richer brother of us two, at least in terms of ready money. What a lark that is! With this fortune I could return to London and set up a shop, but I will continue to prospect, as I believe my luck has not yet run dry. I have not yet declared the ore, and have chosen to export it from the goldfields via a private escort, which I am told is the safest route. Notwithstanding the alteration of my fortune, I am, as ever, yours, Crosby Wells. West Canterbury, June 1865. Sir, you will notice from my postmark that I am no longer a resident of the province of Otago, but have upped my sticks, as the saying goes. You most likely have had little cause to venture west of the mountains, so I shall tell you that West Canterbury is a world apart from the grasses of the south. The sunrise over the coastline is a scarlet marvel, and the snowy peaks hold the colour of the sky. The bush is wet and tangled, and the water very white. It is a lonely place, though not quiet, for the bird song is constant and very pleasant for its constancy. As you may have guessed already, I have put my former life behind me. I am estranged from my wife. I ought to tell you that I concealed much in my correspondence with you, fearing that if you knew the bitter truth about my marriage, you might think less of me. I shall not trouble you with the details of my escape to this place, for it is a sorry tale, and one that saddens me to recall. I am twice bitten, three times shy, which is a less admirable ratio than other men can boast, but suffice to say that I have learnt my lesson. Enough upon that subject. Instead, I shall speak about the present and the future. I mean to dig for gold no longer, though West Canterbury is flush with colour and men are making fortunes every day. No, I will not prospect and have my fortune stolen once again. Instead, I shall try my hand at the timber trade. I have made a fine acquaintance of a Maori man, Te Rau Tau Whare. This name, in his native tongue, means the hundred house of years. What poor names we British fellows have compared to these! I fancy it might be a line from a poem. Tau Whare is a noble savage of the first degree, and we are fast becoming friends. I confess it lifts my spirits to be in the companionship of men again. Yours, etc., Crosby Wells. West Canterbury, August 1865. Sir, I read in the papers that Westland is to have a seat in Parliament, and you are running for that seat. I am proud to say I am now a voting man, sir, for my cottage in the Arahura Valley is not leasehold, it is my very own, and as you know, the ownership of land affords a man a vote. I will place my ballot in your favour and drink to your success. In the meantime, I spend my days felling totara with 1,000 blows of my humble axe. You are a landed man, sir. You have Glen House in London, and also, I presume, your electoral lodgings in handsome Arkaroa. But I have never owned a scrap before. I have been with Mrs. Wells in name, if not in deed, for nigh on 3 years, but all that time I was on the fields, and without a fixed address while she remained in town. Although my present solitude suits me very well, it is the stationary life to which I am unaccustomed. Perhaps we will meet or see each other while you are in Hokitika on your campaign. You must not fear that I will harm you or that I will betray the secret of our father's wrong. I have told no man, and only my estranged wife, and her temperament is such that when she cannot profit from the knowledge, she loses interest in the news. You must not fear me. You need only to send an X on paper to this return address. If you make your mark in this way, I will know that you do not wish to meet, and I should keep away and stop writing and cease my wondering. I would do that gladly. And anything else you ask of me, because I am, yours very truly, Crosby Wells. West Canterbury, October 1865. Sir, I've not received a letter X from you, for which I thank you. Today I'm heartened by your silence, though the very same has caused me grief before. I remain, as ever, yours, Crosby Wells. West Canterbury, December 1865. Sir, I observe in the West Coast Times that you mean to make the passage to Hokitika overland, and therefore will pass through the Arahura Valley, lest you make some deliberately circuitous route. I am a voting man, and as such I would be honoured to welcome a politician at my home, humble though the dwelling is. I shall describe it, so that you might approach or direct your course away as you see fit. The house is roofed in iron, and set back 30 yards from the banks of the Arahura on that river's southern side. There is a clearing of some 30 yards on either side of the cottage, and the sawmill is some 20 yards further to the southeast. The dwelling is a small one with a window and a chimney made of clay-fired brick. It is clad in the usual way. Perhaps, even if you do not stop, I shall see you riding by. I shall not expect it, nor hope for it, but I wish you a pleasant journey westward and a triumphant campaign, and I assure you that I remain, with the deepest admiration, Crosby Wells. This was the final letter. It was dated a little over 2 months prior to the present day, and less than a month before Wells' own death. Moody threw down the page and sat a moment without moving. He did not habitually smoke alone, and so rarely kept tobacco about his person. Right now, however, he wanted very much to be occupied by some compulsive and repeated motion, and briefly wondered whether he ought to ring the bell for a cigarette or a cigar. But he could not bear the thought of speaking to another person, even to deliver a command, and contented himself instead with the task of reshuffling the letters, and returning them to their original order, with the most recent letter placed on top. It was clear from Crosby Wells' repeated allusions to Lauderback's silence that the politician had never once responded to these letters from his bastard half-brother, his father's horse and child. Alistair Lauderback had kept his silence for 13 years. Moody shook his head. 13 years? When Crosby's letters were so yearning and so candid, when the bastard so plainly desired to meet his brother and to look upon him even once. Would it have so harmed Lauderback, the honourable Lauderback, to pen a few words in response? To send a banknote and buy the poor man's passage home? It was extraordinarily callous never to reply. And yet, Moody conceded, Lauderback had kept Wells' letters. He had kept them, and read them and reread them, for the oldest were very worn and had been folded and refolded many times. And he had journeyed to Crosby Wells' cottage in the Arahura Valley, arriving in the last just half an hour too late. But then Moody remembered something else. Lauderback had taken Lydia Wells as his mistress. He had taken his brother's wife as his mistress. Unconscionable, Moody said aloud. He leapt up and began to pace. It was extraordinarily callous. It was inhuman. He made the calculations in his head. Crosby Wells had been on the fields at Dunstan and at Kawarau, and all the while the brother he so desired to meet was in Dunedin making him a cuckold. Could Lauderback have been truly ignorant of this connection? That was hardly likely, for Lydia Wells had taken her husband's surname. Moody stopped. No, he thought. Lauderback had told Balfour explicitly that he had not known that Lydia Wells was married throughout the course of their affair. In all of their dealings with one another, she had used her maiden name Greenway. It was not until Francis Carver returned from jail, calling himself Francis Wells, that Lauderback discovered that Lydia was married and that her name was properly Lydia Wells, and that he, Lauderback, had been cuckolding her husband. Moody rifled back through the pile of letters
until he found the one dated August of the previous year. Yes, Crosby Wells had made it explicitly clear that he had shared the details of his illegitimate parentage with his wife. So Lydia Wells had known about Lauderback's illegitimate brother from the very beginning of their love affair. And she had known, furthermore, that this was a matter about which Lauderback presumably cherished a very raw and private feeling, for he had never replied to Crosby's letters even once. Perhaps, Moody thought, she had even sought out Lauderback with the express purpose of exploiting that connection. Why, the woman was nothing better than a profiteer. To have used both brothers, to have ruined them both. For another thing was now clear. The fortune by which Lauderback had been blackmailed had not originated from Carver's own claim at all. The sum total had been stolen from Crosby Wells. He had been the one to make a strike on the fields at Dunstan, as his correspondence had attested. So Lydia Wells had betrayed Wells' secret to Francis Carver, with whose help she had then devised a plan to steal Wells' fortune and blackmail Lauderback, leaving the pair of them rich and the proud possessors of the bark Godspeed into the bargain. Lauderback was plainly ashamed of his illegitimate relation, as Mrs. Wells, as his mistress, must have known firsthand. Clearly she had devised a scheme to use that shame as leverage. Suddenly Moody's heart gave a lurch. This was the twinkle, the private information by which Francis Carver had blackmailed Lauderback and guaranteed his silence on the sale of the Godspeed. For Carver had called himself Francis Wells, leading Lauderback to believe that he and Crosby were brothers. Fellow Horsons, brought up in the same whorehouse, born perhaps to the same mother. Crosby Wells' surname had been given to him by assignation, and it was not implausible that Crosby Wells might have had other siblings on his mother's side if his mother was a prostitute. What a way to play on Lauderback's sympathies and force his hand! Crosby Lauderback, Moody thought suddenly, feeling a rush of empathy for the man. He thought of Wells dead in his cottage in the Arahura, one hand curled around the base of an empty bottle, his cheek against the table, his eyes closed. How coldly the wheels of fortune turned. How steely Lauderback's heart must have been to maintain his silence in the face of these impassioned appeals. And how pitiful that Crosby Wells had watched his brother's ascension over the course of a decade through the ranks of the provincial council into the very House of Parliament itself, while the bastard struggled in the damp and frost alone. And yet Moody could not repudiate Lauderback altogether. The politician had visited his brother in the end, though with what intention Moody did not know. Perhaps the politician meant to make up for 13 years of silence. Perhaps he had intended to apologize to his half-brother, or merely to look upon him, and speak his name and shake his hand. There were tears in Moody's eyes. He swore, though without conviction, drew the back of his hand roughly across his face, feeling a bitter kinship with the hermit, a man whom he had never seen and would never know. For there was a terrible resemblance between Crosby Wells' situation and his own. Crosby Wells had been abandoned by his father, as had Moody. Crosby Wells had been betrayed by his brother, as had Moody. Crosby Wells had relocated to the southern face of the world in pursuit of his brother, as had Moody, and there he had been spurned and ruined, only to live out his days alone. Moody squared the edges of the letters in his hands. He ought to have rung the bell for the maid an hour ago and demanded the trunk be removed from his room. He would invite suspicion if he delayed any further. He wondered what he should do. There was not enough time to make copies of the entire correspondence. Ought he to return the letters to the lining of the trunk? Ought he to steal them, surrender them to a relevant authority here in Hokitika? They were certainly pertinent to the case at hand, and in the event that a Supreme Court judge was summoned, they would be very valuable indeed. He crossed the room and sat down upon the edge of his bed, thinking. He could send the letters to Lerventhal, with instructions that they were all to be published in sequence and in full in the West Coast Times. He could send them to George Shepherd, the jail warden, begging the latter's advice. He could show them to his friend Gascoigne in confidence. He could summon the 12 men of the Crown and solicit their opinion. He could send them to the Goldfields Commissioner, or better yet, to the magistrate. But to what end? What would come of it? Who would profit from the news? He tapped his fingers together and sighed. At length, Moody gathered up the letter bundle, tied the bow exactly as it had been tied, and replaced the bundle in the lining of the trunk. He fitted the bar back into the hasp, wiped the lid of the trunk, and stood back to make sure everything looked exactly as he had found it. Then he put his hat and coat back on, as though he had only just returned home from Maxwell's dining hall, and rang the bell. The maid stamped upstairs in due course, and in a tone of deep exasperation he told her that the wrong trunk had been delivered to his rooms. He had taken the liberty of opening the trunk and of reading the name inscribed on the interior. It belonged to Mr. Alistair Lauderback, a man whom he had never met, who was certainly not lodging at the Crown Hotel, and whose name bore no resemblance at all to his own. Presumably his own trunk had been sent to Mr. Lauderback's hotel, wherever that was. He intended to spend the afternoon at the billiard hall on Stafford Street, and expected that the mistake would be corrected during the hours of his absence, for it was of the utmost importance that he was reunited with his possessions at the earliest convenience. He planned to attend the widow's drinks and speculation at the wayfarer's fortune that evening, and he wished to do so in appropriate attire. He added, before taking his leave, that he was most severely displeased. A month without a moon, in which the wayfarer's fortune opens to the public at long last. The hanging sign outside the wayfarer's fortune had been repainted so that the jaunty silhouette with his Dick Whittington bundle was now walking beneath a starry sky. If the stars formed a constellation above the painted figure's head, Mannering did not recognize it. He glanced up at the sign only briefly as he mounted the steps to the veranda, noting as he did so that the knocker had been polished, the windows washed, the doormat replaced, and a fresh card fitted into the plate beside the door. Mrs. Lydia Wells, medium, spiritist, secrets uncovered, fortunes told. At his knock he heard female voices, and then quick footsteps on the stairs ascending. He waited, hoping that it would be Anna who received him. There was a rattling sound as the chain was unhooked. Mannering touched the knot of his necktie with his fingers and stood a little straighter, looking at his faint reflection in the glass. The door opened. Dick Mannering! Mannering was disappointed, but he did not show it.
Mrs. Wells, he exclaimed. A very good evening to you.
I certainly hope it will be. But it is not the evening yet.
She smiled.
I would expect you of all people to know that it is dreadfully unfashionable to arrive early to a party. What would my mother call it? A barbarism.
Am I early?
Mannering said, reaching for his pocket watch in a pretense of surprise. He knew very well that he was early. He desired to arrive before the others, so as to get a chance to speak with Anna alone.
Oh, yes, look at that,
he added, squinting at the watch. He shrugged and tucked it back into the pocket of his vest.
I must have forgotten to wind it this morning. Well, I'm here now, and so are you. Dressed for the occasion? Very handsome indeed.
She was wearing widow's weeds, though her costume had been enhanced, as she might have phrased it, in various small ways, and these enhancements belied its somber tone. The black bodice had been embroidered with vines and roses, stitched in a glossy thread, so that the designs winked and flashed upon her breast. She wore another black rose upon a band of black that was fitted as a cuff around the plump whiteness of her forearm, and a third black rose in her hair, pinned into the hollow behind her ear. She was still smiling.
"What am I to do now?" she said. "You've put me in a dreadful position, Mr. Mannering. I cannot invite you in. To do so would only encourage you to arrive early on other occasions. Before long, you would be inconveniencing men and women of society all over town. But I cannot turn you out into the street either, for then you and I will both be barbarians. You for your impudence, and me for my inhospitality.
"Seems there's a third option," said Mannering. "Let me stand on the porch all night while you mull it over, and by the time you make up your mind, I'll be right on time."
"There's another barbarism," said Mrs. Wells. "Your temper."
"You've never seen my temper, Mrs. Wells."
"Have I not?"
"Never. With you, I'm a civilized man."
"With whom are you uncivilized, one wonders?"
"It's not a matter of with whom," said Mannering. "It's a matter of how far."
There was a brief pause.
"How grand that must have felt," said Mrs. Wells presently.
"When?"
"Just then," said Mrs. Wells. "What you just said, it must have felt grand."
"There's a certain style about you, Mrs. Wells. I'd forgotten it."
"Is there?"
"Yes, a certain style."
Mannering reached into his pocket.
"Here's the tariff. Daylight robbery, by the way. You can't charge 3 shillings in Okatika for an evening's entertainment. Not if you're calling up Helen of Troy. The fellas won't stand for it. Though I oughtn't to be giving you advice. As of this evening, you and I are direct competitors. Don't think that I don't know it. It'll be the Prince of Wales or the Wayfarer's fortune when the boys turn out their pockets of a Saturday night. I'm a man who takes notice of my competition, and I'm here tonight to take notice of you."
"A woman likes to be noticed," said Mrs. Wells.
She accepted the coins, and then pulled the door wide.
"Anyway," she added as Mannering stepped into the hall, "you're a rotten liar. If you'd forgotten to wind your watch, you wouldn't have been early. You'd have been late."
She shut the door behind him and set the chain.
"You're in black,"
Mannering observed.
"Naturally," she returned. "I am recently widowed, and therefore in mourning."
"Here's a fact," Mannering said. "The colour black is invisible to spirits. I'll make a bet that you didn't know that, did you now? It's why we wear black at funerals. If we dressed in colour, we'd attract the attention of the dead. Wearing black, they can't make us out."
"What a charming piece of trivia," said Mrs. Wells.
"Do you know what it means, though? It means that Mr. Staines won't be able to see you. Not in that gown. You'll be quite invisible to him."
She laughed.
"Dear me. Well, there's nothing to be done, I suppose. Not at this late stage. I shall have to call the whole evening off."
"And Anna," said Mannering, "what colour will she be wearing tonight?"
"Black, as a matter of fact," said Mrs. Wells, "for she is in mourning also."
"You're scuppered," said Mannering. "The whole enterprise, and all on account of your gowns. How's that for a stick in a wheel? Thwarted by your own gowns."
Mrs. Wells was no longer smiling.
"You are irreverent," she said, "to make sport of the tokens of bereavement."
"You and I both, Mrs. Wells."
They looked at each other for a moment, each searching the other's expression.
"I have the greatest respect for swindlers," said Mannering presently. "I ought to, seeing as I count myself among them. But fortune-telling, that's a poor swindle, Mrs. Wells. I'm sorry to say it plain, but there it is."
Her expression was still cautious. Lightly, she said,
"How so?"
"It's nothing better than a falsehood," said Mannering stoutly. "Tell me the name of the next man to bet against me. Buy me into my next game of brag. Give me the winner of next week's races. You wouldn't do it, would you? No, you wouldn't, because you can't."
"I see that you like to doubt, Mr. Mannering."
"I'm an old hand at this game, that's why."
"Yes,"
said the widow, still gazing at him.
"You relish doubting."
"Give me the winner of next week's races, and I'll never doubt again."
"I cannot."
Mannering spread his hands.
"There you have it."
"I cannot, because in asking me for such a thing, you are not asking me to tell your fortune. You are asking me to give you an incontrovertible proof of my own ability. That is what I cannot do. I am a fortune-teller, not a logician."
"Poor fortune-teller, though, if you can't see ahead to next Sunday."
One of the first lessons one learns in this discipline is that nothing about the future is incontrovertible, said Mrs. Wells. The reason is very simple. A person's fortune always changes in the telling of it.
You're feathering your own nest with that argument.
She lifted her chin slightly.
If you were a jockey in next week's horse race, and you came to me and asked to know if your fortune was likely good, well, that would be a different story. If I pronounced that your fortune was very gloomy, you would likely ride poorly because you would be dejected. If I made a favourable forecast, you would likely ride with confidence and thus do well.
All right. I'm not a jockey, said Mannering, but I am a punter with £5 riding on a mare called Irish. That's the truth. And I'm asking you to tell my fortune, good or bad. What's my forecast?
She smiled. I doubt your fortunes would be very much altered by the loss or gain of £5, Mr. Mannering. And in any case, you are still seeking proof. Come through into the parlour.
The interior of the Wayfarer's fortune hardly recalled the grimy establishment at which Mrs. Wells had received Aubert Gascoigne 3 weeks prior. The widow had ordered drapes, a new suite of furniture, and a dozen rolls of paper in a striking rose and thorn design. She had set a number of exotic prints behind glass, painted the stairwell, washed the windows, and papered both front rooms. She had found a lectern upon which to place her almanac, and several shawled lamps, which she had placed in various situations around the former hotel's front rooms, in order to create a more mystical atmosphere. Mannering opened his mouth to comment upon the transformation, and came up short.
"Why, it's Mr. Sook!" he said in astonishment. "And Mr. Kui!"
The two Chinese men stared back at him. They were sitting cross-legged on either side of the hearth, their faces painted very thickly with grease.
"Do you know these men?" said Lydia Wells.
Mannering remembered himself.
"Only to look at them," he said. "I do a fair patch of business with the Chinamen, you know, and these boys are familiar faces in Canyere. How do you do, fellows?"
"Good evening,"
said Ah Sook. Ah Kui said nothing. Their expressions were all but indistinguishable beneath the grease paint, which exaggerated their features, lengthening the corners of their eyes, emphasizing the roundness of their cheeks. Mannering turned to Mrs. Wells.
"What? They have a part in the séance, do they? In your employ?"
"This one came by this afternoon," Mrs. Wells explained, pointing at Ah Sook, "and I had the idea that his presence might add a certain flavour to the séance this evening. He agreed to return, and in the event he did me one better. He brought his friend along. You must agree that two is a good deal better than one. I like an axis of symmetry in a room."
"Where is Anna?" said Mannering.
"Oh, upstairs," said Mrs. Wells. "In fact, it was you, Mr. Mannering, who gave me the idea. Your sensations from the Orient. Nothing sells tickets like an Oriental touch. I saw it twice, once from the gallery and once from the stalls."
Mannering was frowning.
"When is she coming down?"
"Not until the séance," said Mrs. Wells.
He started.
"What? Not for the party? She won't be here for the party?"
Mrs. Wells turned away to arrange the glasses on the sideboard.
"No."
"Why ever not?" said Mannering. "You know there are a dozen men champing at the bit to get a word in with her. They're shelling out a week's wages just to get in the door, and it's all on account of Anna. You'd be mad to keep her upstairs."
"She must prepare herself for the séance. I cannot have her equilibrium disturbed."
"Poppycock," said Mannering.
"Pardon me?"
said Mrs. Wells, turning.
"I said that's poppycock. You're keeping her back for a reason."
"What do you imply?"
"I lost my best girl in Anna Wetherill," said Mannering. "I've kept my distance for 3 weeks, out of respect for God knows what, and now I want a chance to speak with her. There's no such thing as equilibrium disturbed, and we both know it."
"I feel I must remind you that this is a field in which you lack expertise."
"Expertise?"
said Mannering contemptuously.
3 weeks ago, Anna didn't know equilibrium from her own elbow. This is poppycock, Mrs. Wells. Call her down.
Mrs. Wells drew back.
I must also remind you, Mr. Mannering, that you are a guest in my home.
This isn't a home, it's a place of business. I'd paid you 3 shillings on the surety that Anna would be here.
In fact, no such surety was given.
Hear this, said Mannering, who was becoming very angry. I'll give you another piece of advice, Mrs. Wells, and I'll give it to you free. In show business, you give an audience exactly what they've paid for, and if you don't, you'll suffer the consequences of their unrest. It said in the paper that Anna would be here.
It said in the paper that she would be present at the sales as my assistant.
What have you got on her?
I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
Why did she agree to it? To stay upstairs, alone and in the dark?
Mrs. Wells ignored this question.
Miss Wetherill, she said, has been learning to play out the patterns of the tarot, an art at which she has proven to be something of an adept. Once I'm satisfied that she has achieved mastery, she will advertise her services in the West Coast Times, and at that time you will be very welcome, as will all the citizens of Hokitika, to make an appointment with her.
And I'll be paying through the nose for the privilege, will I?
But of course, said Mrs. Wells, I wonder that you expected otherwise.
Ah Sook was looking at Mrs. Wells, Ah Kui at Mannering.
This is an outrage, Mannering said.
Perhaps you no longer wish to attend the party, said Mrs. Wells. If that is the case, you need only say so. I shall repay your tariff in full.
What's the point of it? Keeping her upstairs.
The widow laughed.
Come, Mr. Mannering, we are in the same business, as you have already pointed out. I don't need to spell it out for you.
No, spell it out, said Mannering. Go on, spell it out.
Mrs. Wells did not, however. She gazed at him a moment and then said,
Why did you come to the party tonight?
To speak with Anna, and to get a measure of my competition. You.
The first of your ambitions will not be realized, as I have now made clear, and you surely must have achieved the second by now. This being the case, I do not see that there is any reason for you to remain.
I'm staying, Mannering said.
Why?
To keep an eye on you, that's why.
I see.
Mrs. Wells gazed at him.
I think that there is another reason why you decided to attend the party tonight. A reason that you have not hitherto shared with me.
Ah? And what might that be? Said Mannering.
I'm afraid I can only guess, said Mrs. Wells.
Well, go on. Make your prediction. That's your game, isn't it? Tell my fortune.
She put her head to the side, appraising him. Then she said, suddenly decisive,
No, this time I believe I shall keep my prediction to myself.
Mannering faltered. And after a moment, Mrs. Wells gave her tinkling laugh and drew herself upright, clasping her hands together over her bosom. Begging Mannering's leave to depart, she explained that she had hired 2 barmaids from the Star and Garter to wait on her guests that evening, and the girls had not yet been briefed. They were waiting in the kitchen very patiently, and she would not suffer them to wait a moment longer. She invited Mannering to pour himself a drink from the decanters set out upon the sideboard and to make himself very much at home. And with that, she swept from the room, leaving Mannering staring after her, red-faced. Once the door had closed behind her, he rounded on Ah Sook.
What have you got to say for yourself, then?
To see Emery Staines, said Ah Sook.
You've got some questions for him, I suppose.
Yes.
Dead or alive, said Mannering. It's one or the other, isn't it, Mr. Sook? It's one or the other at this stage.
He stamped to the sideboard and poured himself a very stiff drink. Mrs. Wells had hired a 2-man orchestra, comprising a fiddle and a flute, from the Catholic Friendly Society on Collingwood Street. The musicians arrived a little before 7, their instruments rolled in velvet, and Mrs. Wells directed them to the end of the hallway, where 2 chairs had been set up facing the door. The only songs they knew were jigs and hornpipes, but Mrs. Wells had lit upon the idea that they might play their repertoire at a quarter time, or as slowly as their breath and coordination would permit, in order to be more in keeping with the tenor of the evening. Played slowly, the jigs turned sinister, and the hornpipes became sad. Even Mannering, whose bad temper had not been assuaged by two fingers of brandy and the cheerful ministration of the Star and Garter barmaids, had to admit that the effect was very striking. When the first guests knocked upon the door, Sixpenny Money was sounding at an aching drawl, putting one in mind not of dancing and celebration, but of funerals, sickness, and very bad news. By 8 o'clock, the former hotel had reached capacity, and the air was thick with smoke. Have you ever watched a magician at a market? Have you ever seen a cup and ball man at work? Well, it's all in the art of diversion, Mr. Frost. They have ways of making you look away, by means of a joke or a noise or something unexpected. And while your head is turned, that's when the cups get swapped or filled or emptied or what have you. I don't need to tell you that no diversion's as good as a woman, and tonight you'll be contending with two. Frost glanced at Pritchard uncomfortably, and then away. He was a little afraid of the chemist, and he did not like the way that Pritchard was looming over him, standing so close that when he spoke, Frost could feel the heat of his breath. "How do you propose I'm not diverted?" he said. "You keep both eyes open," Pritchard said. "Nielsen watches Anna, you watch the widow. Between the two of you, you've got them covered, you see. You watch Lydia Wells, no matter what. If she invites you to close your eyes or look elsewhere, they often do that, you know. Well, don't." Frost felt a twinge of irritation at this. He wondered what right Joseph Pritchard had to allocate duties of surveillance at a séance to which he did not hold an invitation. And why was he assigned to the widow when Nielsen got Anna? He did not voice these complaints aloud, however, for a barmaid was approaching with a decanter on a tray. Both men filled their glasses, thanked her, and watched her move away through the crowd. As soon as she had left, Pritchard resumed with the same intensity. "Staines has got to be somewhere," he insisted. "A man doesn't just vanish without a trace. What do we know for sure? Let us catalogue it. We know that Anna was the very last to see him alive. We know that she was lying about that opium, saying she'd eaten that ounce herself when I saw for myself that that was a plain-faced lie. And we know that now she's fixing to call him up from the dead." It occurred to Frost suddenly that Pritchard's jacket fit him very ill, and that his necktie had not been pressed, and that his shirt was all but threadbare. Why, and his razor must be very blunt, Frost thought, to produce so uneven and patchy a shave. This criticism, internally voiced, gave him a sudden confidence. He said, "You don't trust Anna very much, do you, Mr. Pritchard?" Pritchard seemed taken aback by the assumption. "There is ample reason not to trust her," he said coldly, "as I've just chronicled for you."
"But personally," Frost said, "as a woman, I gather that your impression of her integrity is very low."
"You talk of a whore's integrity," Pritchard burst out,
but he did not go on. After a moment, Frost added,
"I wonder what you think of her, that's all."
Pritchard stared at Frost with a vacant expression. "No," he said at last, "I don't trust Anna. I don't trust her a straw. I don't even love her, but I wish I did. Isn't that a curious thing? I wish I did." Frost was uncomfortable.
"Hardly worth 3 shillings, is it?" he said, referring to the party. "I must say I expected more."
Pritchard seemed embarrassed also. "Just remember," he said, "during the séance, keep both eyes on Mrs. Wells." They turned away from one another, pretending to scan the faces of the crowd, and for a moment the two men shared the very same expression. The distant, slightly disappointed aspect of one who is comparing the scene around him unfavourably to other scenes, both real and imagined, that have happened and are happening elsewhere.
Mr. Balfour, may I speak with you a moment alone?
Balfour glanced up. It was Harold Nielsen, looking characteristically dapper in a vest of imperial blue. He saw on Nielsen's face the hardened expression of a man who is resolved to ask a difficult question, and his heart became heavy in his chest.
"Of course, naturally, naturally," he said. "You can speak to me, of course you can speak to me, naturally."
What fools men became, he thought, when they knew they were about to be shamed. He followed Nielsen through the crowd. When they were out of earshot of the parlour, Nielsen stopped abruptly.
"I'll get right to it," he said, turning on his heel.
"Yes," said Balfour, "get right to it. That's always best. How do you like the party?"
From the sitting room came a roar of laughter and a woman's indignant squeal.
"I like it very well," said Nielsen. "No sign of Anna, though."
"No."
"And 3 shillings," said Balfour. "That's a price. We'll be drinking our money's worth, won't we?"
He looked into his glass.
"I'll get right to it," Nielsen said again.
"Yes," said Balfour, "do."
"Somehow," Nielsen began, "Mr. Lauderback knows about my commission. He's publishing a letter in the paper about it tomorrow, lambasting Shepherd's character and so forth. I haven't seen it yet."
"Oh, dear," Balfour said. "Oh, dear, yes, I see, I see."
He nodded vigorously, though not at Nielsen. They were standing almost side by side. Nielsen was directing his speech at a framed print upon the wall, and Balfour at the wainscot.
"Governor Shepherd penned a reply," Nielsen went on, still addressing the print, "which is to appear directly underneath Lauderback's in tomorrow's paper. I've seen the reply. Shepherd sent me a copy this afternoon."
He gave a brief account of Shepherd's response, causing Balfour's anxiety to dissolve in a moment into pure astonishment.
"Well," he said, looking squarely at Nielsen for the first time, "I'm blowed. That's a shark in shallow water, all right. Fancy Gov Shepherd coming up with something like that, saying it's all your instigation, the investment, as a donation. I'm blowed. He's got you in a corner, hasn't he? What a confident devil that man is. What a snake."
"Did you tell Mr. Lauderback about my commission?" Nielsen said.
"No," said Balfour.
"You didn't even mention it offhand?"
"No," said Balfour, "not a bit."
"All right," Nielsen said heavily. "Thanks. I'm sorry to have troubled you. I suppose it has to be one of the others."
Balfour started.
"One of the others? You mean one of the fellows from the Crown?"
"Yes," Nielsen said. "Somebody must have broken his oath. I certainly didn't tell Mr. Lauderback anything. And I'm certain that nobody else knows about the investment beyond the 12 who swore."
Balfour was looking panicked.
"What about your boy?" he said.
Nielsen shook his head.
"He doesn't know."
"Someone at the bank, maybe?"
"No, it was a private agreement, and Shepherd has the only copy of the deed."
Nielsen sighed.
"Listen," he said, "I'm sorry for having sprung it on you, for having asked, you know, and doubted you. But I knew you were Lauderback's man, and, well, I had to make sure."
"Naturally you did, of course."
Nielsen nodded gloomily. He looked through the drawing-room doorway to the crowd beyond, to Pritchard, who stood a clear head taller than any other man in the room, to Devlin, who stood in conversation with Clinch, to Lerventhal, who was talking to Frost, to Mannering, who was refilling his glass from the decanter on the sideboard, and laughing very freely at another man's joke.
"Hang tight," said Balfour suddenly. "You said that Shepherd's letter mentioned Lauderback and Lydia Wells."
"Yes," said Nielsen uncomfortably. "He's made their affair all but public knowledge, saying that Lauderback must come clean about her. That's the—"
Balfour interrupted him.
"But how in all heaven does Shepherd know about the affair in the first place? I hardly think that Lauderback would have—"
"I told him,"
Nielsen burst out.
"I broke my oath. Oh, Mr. Balfour, he had me in a corner, and he knew I was hiding something, and I buckled. I couldn't think fast enough. You've every right to be furious with me.
You've every right. I don't mind.
Not at all, said Balfour, to whom this confession had come as a strange relief.
Now Lauterbach will know you didn't keep his confidence, Nielsen went on miserably, and by tomorrow morning all of Westland will know that he took a mistress in Mrs. Wells, and perhaps he'll lose the seat in Parliament, and it's all my fault. I'm ever so sorry. Truly I am.
What else did you tell him? Balfour said. About Anna? And the blackmail and the gowns?
No, said Nielsen, looking shocked. And nothing about Carver, either. All I said was that Mrs. Wells had been Lauterbach's mistress. That was all. But now Governor Shepherd's gone and said as much in the paper.
Well, that's quite all right, said Balfour, clapping Nielsen on the shoulder. That's quite all right. Governor Shepherd might have found that out from anywhere. If Lauterbach asks, I'll tell him that I've never spoken two words to Shepherd in all my life, and that will be the truth.
I'm dreadfully sorry, said Nielsen.
Not a bit, said Balfour, patting him. Not a bit of it.
Well, you're very kind to say so, said Nielsen.
Happy to help, said Balfour.
I still don't know who sold me out to Lauterbach in the first place, Nielsen said, after a moment. I'll have to keep asking, I suppose.
He sighed and turned again to scan the faces of the crowd.
I say, Mr. Nielsen, Balfour said, I've thought of something. Apropos of nothing at all, really. Here. Next time I have some commission work, next time something comes across my desk, you know, I might not go to Mr. Cochrane after all. You know, he's had my business for a long time, but, well, I wonder if it might be time for a change. I'll wager we'll all come out of this business looking for a man to lean on, looking for a man to trust. As I say, you'll have it, my business, in the future.
He did not look at Nielsen. He began to fish in his jacket pocket for a cigar.
That's very kind of you, said Nielsen.
He watched Balfour for a moment longer, and then, nodding slowly, turned away. Balfour found a cigar, unwrapped it, bit off its end, and placed it between his teeth. Then he struck his match, angled it so the flame caught, and held the flame to the square end of the cigar. He puffed at it three times, blowing out his cheeks. Then he shook out the match, plucked the cigar from his mouth, and turned it around to make sure that the tobacco was burning.